One of the things that Jason's going to tell you in this interview is that when he launched Mahalo Answers, there were people on his website, on Mahalo.com, waiting for that launch, waiting to see what he was going to launch, what it was going to be like, and what he was going to do with it. And I can tell you from experience that people were talking about it before the launch. They were on the website the day of the launch, and they were on the website afterwards because I've talked to these people. And the reason I wanted to do this interview is to help you learn how Jason does it. How does he build up that kind of buzz? And more importantly, because I think Jason is interesting, but more importantly for you, how can you use it? Because I think you're much more interesting than Jason, at least to yourself. You're coming here because you want to find out how you can build your business, and this interview is going to help you do that, like all interviews that I do. You're going to hear Jason in this interview talk about what brands, what the value of a brand is, how to pick your brand, how to promote your brand, how to live your brand. He's going to talk about social media and what role that will play in helping you build up your company. He's going to talk about how to build buzz, about being internet famous. How do you become internet famous? What does it mean to be internet famous? How does it impact your business, right? It all comes back to your project, your baby, how all these ideas impact your baby. And that's what we're going to talk about. Also, towards the end of this interview, you'll hear us talk about failure. I asked Jason about his past failures because he talked throughout the interview about his successes, and rightly so. I wanted to find out how everything he was teaching you related to his business so that you can see that his experience is what shapes his ideas. But at the end of the interview, I asked to find out about his failures and what that meant for him and how that impacted him and what you do when your business starts to fail. All right, that's a long rant for an introduction that I think, that went a little bit longer than usual, but it's important for you to see what's coming up here. It's packed with information. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, where I will fight to find out the kinds of information you need so that you can build a powerful business. Because if you shine, if you build a strong business, I know when you're on the cover of Fortune magazine, you're going to say, you know, one of the things that helped me get here is listening to Andrew Warner and all those interviews that he did on Mixergy.com, including this one with Jason Calacanis. Here it is. What's the accomplishment that you're proudest of?
Oh, wow. Professionally or personally?
Professionally.
I guess that's the question. So on a professional basis, I'm very proud of the first magazine I produced because I had no experience in magazines, and I was able to build it from a cold start, you know, to a 300 or 400-page glossy magazine, you know, just off my credit cards. And that was quite a run for me. I was also proud of not giving up when the dot-com crash happened. I mean, I worked through it, which was very painful, and I'm actually writing an editorial about that. But it's I think I learned a lot more when the market crashed in 2001, 2002, than I did, you know, in the 6 years of going up with Silicon Valley Reporter and, you know, making a lot of money, being offered a lot of money to buy the company, not selling it, and all that pain of ups and downs. I mean, I think that's what really made me into the entrepreneur I am. And, you know, of course, you know, the brands we built at Weblogs Inc., which I get a lot of credit for, but it's sort of unfair because I didn't really put the work into those brands. The people who worked on them did, but you know, TV Squad, Cinematical, Autoblog, Joystick, of course, Engadget, Hackaday. These blogs, I mean a lot to people. Even some of the niche ones like Wow Insider or Massively or Joystick, and it's really cool that those brands still exist and that they've stood the test of time. And truth be told, I worked on those brands for a year to 18 months, maybe 2 years each. They're now all, you know, they've lived inside of AOL for 3 years. We were an independent company for a year and a half. So they've had a life twice as long inside of Time Warner, and one third of their life was out of it when I ran it. So I think that's a really good sign when you're an entrepreneur, when the brands you build are strong enough that they can survive even being inside of a big corporation.
All right, and let's look forward. 5, 10 years, what are you going to be proudest of then professionally? Is it company goes public? Is it that it brings in a certain amount of revenue? Is it that you've got your own jet while all this happening? Is all this happening?
Well, as you know, every entrepreneur aspires towards owning a jet and a sports team.
Finally, talk to laughs at me for saying that I'd like to have a jet. Finally, somebody who acknowledges it, a jet and a sports team.
The only people who say they don't want to have a jet are people who have never flown on a private jet or are lying.
Huh?
But anyway, listen, the fact that I'm even able to fly on, you know, commercial planes is sort of amazing to me, because when I was a kid, you know, we couldn't go on vacation anywhere that was more than 6 hours away from New York City, because we were driving wherever we went. I didn't take my first plane ride until I was, you know, in high school, and I went to Florida for the first time. So the whole concept of air travel was sort of out of my realm of possibility growing up. You know, for me, I don't really have much left to prove as an entrepreneur. I've done 3 companies, all of which did really well. However, I would like to build Mahalo into a brand that reaches 20, 30, 40 million people a month. I've built a lot of brands that reach 1 million people, 5 million people, maybe an aggregate, you know, 10 million people. But I'd like to get to that next level where it's 20, 30, 40, 50 million people coming to it every month, because then you have a brand that really is, you know, big at scale. And I've always operated on the startup end, you know, the first 5 years of a company. And with Mahalo, what I'm trying to do is operate on the startup end and also get it to scale. Like, I'm not interested in selling it. We've already had 2 offers to buy the company, which I haven't talked about, but you know, we could have sold the company already, and I'm not really interested in selling it. I'm interested in building it into the next Yahoo or Google or, you know, AOL or, you know, Netscape. You know, pick your legendary brand. I'd like to build it into a legendary brand, and that's going to take 5-6 years, I think, of really hard work, and we're only a year and a half into it. So,
all right. And by the way, because we're on a webcam, it looks a little bit. It's hard to get the right shot. I think if you lean back like that, you look way better.
Okay.
Yes, that way we get all of you in there.
Okay.
All right. So one of the things that I think that you're incredible at, and when I ask people for questions, they agreed with me on this, it's traffic. You know how to get people to come over to your website. And Mark Jeffrey, who works with you, suggested that I not ask you so much about how you're getting traffic today, because today you've got a head start on others who are just starting out. He said, ask Jason about how he started getting traffic in the early days, because that will be educational to people who are just starting today and trying to get traffic. How'd you start?
Well, when I did Silicon Valley Reporter magazine, I had an expression which I said, you have to live the brand. And what I had T-shirts made up that said Silicon Valley Reporter, and they were black, and I wore one every day for probably maybe a year or two when I started the brand. And everybody would look at it because it had a really beautiful logo. So I'm a believer in beautiful logos, number one, and a really great brand name. So Engadget, Autoblog, Joystick, Silicon Alley Reporter, Digital Coast Reporter, Mahalo, TechCrunch 50, they all have memorable names, I think. And then if you look at the logos, I spend extra time on the logos. I never really talk about that so much, but it's a good question. So I'm a little bit obsessive about a beautiful domain name, a beautiful logo, a domain name that you can spell over the phone, a domain name that is under a certain number of characters. And so once you have I guess some people might call that brand identity. I think you need to have a really solid brand identity, and you have to suffer over creating it. Even Autoblog, I mean, we debated that name because it was so simple, Autoblog, very descriptive. But we made it a good-looking logo, and it became a brand over time. The mug I'm sipping from has the Mahalo logo. So when you come to our office, you get to see, you know, those. When you come here and have a cup of coffee, you're going to be drinking from our logo. So be the brand in all ways. I would go to events for Silicon Valley Reporter wearing the T-shirt. I would have a backpack filled with 100 copies of the magazine, and I would be walking around with a handful of them. And I think some other people thought it was a little bit crass, but I would rather be known as being a little over-aggressive or crass and handing one to everybody than have them not know Silicon Valley Reporter. And so, you know, if you had to pick those 2 choices. And if, you know, they may not have liked, you know, me handing it to them, but, you know, I handed one to JFK Jr. at a Knicks game and wound up having a conversation with him about it. You know, I sent one to Jan Wenner from Rolling Stone and to Graydon Carter from Vanity Fair. Wound up talking to both of those guys about the magazine business. So you have to be aggressive in getting your message out there to people, I think, and building a really great brand. And if you don't live it, why should anybody else? And so even with the teams I build, if I find people who are not proud of the brand. You know, like I had some people on the team who were like, I don't really feel like Twittering this. I'm not really interested in putting this on my Facebook page. That's my personal page. I don't want to promote Mahalo on it. It's like, why are you working here? You know, I just, those are the first people I would get rid of. I like people who live the brand and are proud of their brand. I think it's a big mistake entrepreneurs make, young entrepreneurs. When you go to the Sundance Film Festival, you'll see a pack of people walking around with a hat on. And it has the logo of their film, and they have jackets with the logo on the back. And that's become like a tradition there. When you're involved in a film, you get some swag, and the team wears it, so you can be identified with it, because people are just walking around. Mm-hmm. It's like a Sundance hack. And so I think, you know, you got to come up with some hacks for Web 2.0. How do you, what's the equivalent? Maybe it's, you know, when I had my Twitter icon for a long time was the Mahalo flower. And that was advertised on every single person's page where the followers were. And people started to identify with me. They identify the Bulldogs with me, you know, your signature file, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think you have to think about being the brand.
But Jason, even someone like you who's out a lot, you might meet 5,000 people a year, maybe let's say 20,000 people in a year. They're going to get your magazine and have to remember to come back to the newsstand or come back to your website and right. take a look at it for themselves. There's a big drop-off over there. There needs to be something bigger than that that's bringing in traffic, isn't there, that's bringing in a big audience? No.
The thing that I've realized is that the number one thing that builds audience is a great product. And so, you know, those 5,000, 10,000, even if it's 100,000 people, even if you got it to 1,000,000 people, if the product sucks, they're not coming back. If you give it to 5,000, if you give it to 50 people and the product is so extraordinary that they have to tell their friends about it, then you're onto a winner. So it's not one or the other. You have to have the amazing product that's worth telling people about, and then you have to have, you know, you have to be the brand. And so if you can put those two things, you know, you'll break out. I think the problem is some people get a little obsessive about marketing, and they forget that they don't have a great brand. And then there are other people who have a great brand, and maybe they don't market it enough.
And yes, to those people, what would you tell those people? I feel like a lot of people who are watching this feel that they have a great product. They spend all their days on their product because they love it, but they're not so comfortable marketing it. Or maybe they're not as good as you at marketing it. What would you tell those people?
I think you have to be willing to put yourself out there with the product and say, you know, something as simple as, hey, can I show you what I'm working on? Mm-hmm. You know, that's a very simple, humble phrase, you know, but if you go to if I go to a tech conference, for example, and, you know, in the old days, I was the guy who was trying to get people to look at what I was doing. Now I'm the old man who people want to come show me what they're doing. And, you know, if people come to me and say, can I talk to you about what I'm doing? I absolutely glaze over. Because I've had 1,000,000 conversations. I don't need to have the 1,000,000th and one about how you're going to change the world. It's frankly very boring. If somebody comes up and says, with an open laptop, and says, can I show you my product and get your feedback on it? It will only take 2 minutes. I'll say, absolutely, go ahead. And I think that's what people forget. They like to talk. They don't like to show.
I see.
And as I was saying in the TechCrunch 50 conference, and when I showed people in those editorials on how to present well, the key to presenting is showing, not telling. And so, you know, when people get up on that stage, I have reviewed their presentation with them. At any point, if they start talking about what the product does, I stop them and say, stop. You're talking about the fact that the product has great search features. Show the search. Do a search for Tesla and show that you disambiguate between Tesla the car and Tesla the scientist and Tesla the rock band. Show it. Don't talk about it. And if you can't show it, then your product's not ready. You know, and I think that's where people get caught up in it. They start, even if they have got a good product, they start talking about what they're going to build next. And they forget to talk about what they have now. I think Steve Jobs is a good roadmap for this. He doesn't talk about what's coming. He talks about what's here. What can you buy now? And Howard Stern also had a key point about that, which I always remember, which was he would only go on David Letterman and you know, Jay Leno, they always wanted him to be on because they knew that would be like their big killer night for ratings because he was so outrageous. Well, Howard Stern only went on when he was selling a pay-per-view, a book, a set of CDs, or moving to Sirius. So, you know, you saw him on David Letterman before Christmas 2 years ago, and he came with a Sirius satellite radio, handed it to David Letterman, said, this is a great gift. I want to suggest everybody buy this over the holidays. I mean, Howard Stern is one of the most famous people in media, and he's out there, you know, saying, hey, buy this product. I'm proud of it. I'm proud of what I'm doing. And, you know, you have to be willing to sell, and most people are not. And that's fine. If you're not willing to sell your product, then it gives more market share to the people who are willing to.
All right, and speaking of products, one of your new ones is Mahalo Answers. And I asked people on Mahalo Answers what they wanted to know from you. Easy E-Boy asked, what is your guerrilla marketing strategy? And you shared a little bit about it with the t-shirts, but yeah. I know that there's more. What do you say to Easy E-Boy?
Obviously social marketing, social media optimization, I guess they call it, has become a very big term, and I think rightfully so. I mean, it's kind of icky to think about social optimization, you know, optimizing your friends and relationships, but it does go back to this building the brand and being the brand, and there really is no separation between you and your business, and there's becoming less of a separation between your business life and your personal life. So people know me as much for Taurus and Fondue.
Your dog.
The Tesla, the car I drive, and the company I run, and I'm okay with that. And I essentially I put out little nuggets of my life. You know, I'm playing poker with this famous person. I'm at Paris Hilton's house. I'm driving a Tesla. I'm walking Taurus and Fondue. Whatever, you know, I'm at Sundance. Just little nuggets of what I'm up to. I'm making cassoulet. I mean, I've had more people talk to me about the cassoulet we made over the holidays than Mahalo, but it's an authentic conversation. People like cassoulet, people like duck confit, you know, and it's fun to make. And so now, you know, so if you use your social presence strictly to promote yourself, people get bored very quickly. I probably, you know, am 50-50 between my personal life and my professional life on my social media presence. And I think that's the new guerrilla marketing. I also think relationships are a killer part of being the brand. So I personally go to the sign-up page for people who've signed up for Mahalo under the spy feature of Mahalo Answers. I open up 20 tabs, and I send them each an email, a question. What do you think of Mahalo Answers so far with a $1 tip on it? So if they answer the question, they get a Mahalo dollar, which cost me 75 cents, if they ever cash it out. They'll probably just pass it along. And what that does is, those 10 people, 20 people I do that to every day have some contact with the CEO of the company. It makes them feel like, gee, if Jason cares about the company this much, maybe I should care. Maybe there's something going on here. And now they've got a dollar to go spend in the system, which then proves to them how good the system is, which also, you know, results in one of the people answering questions to get to win the dollar, and it just perpetuates everything. Now there's another page of Mahalo that could be indexed in Google or Yahoo and create SEO traffic. So, you know, this participation thing is key. Kevin Rose is a great example of that. He doesn't have to go do guerrilla stuff. He can just participate in his brand, and when people see him commenting on a story or him submit a story, it immediately makes it to the front page. And he also, you know, was doing, you know, similar things to me with Quick and Twitter, and he's got twice as many Twitter users as I do. I mean, he's much more famous. And just him, you know, doing a little Quick about making some type of tea or something, or, you know, grilled cheese is, you know, going to create that connection, that relationship. And we live in a relationship-based economy to a certain extent. And those relationships then, those tribes of people, I think that's the guerrilla marketing today. And so, you know, you have this little tribe of people out there who are fans of Mahalo Answers, and they're spreading it for us. We don't need to spread it. That's the new guerrilla marketing, is turning your customers into product evangelists. And I think it's pretty obvious. I mean, people understand what I'm saying about that, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's not my idea. It's an idea that's been around for a long time. But creating product evangelists like Easy Boy or some of the other people who are the top users in Mahalo Answers, I mean, they're spending an hour, 2 hours a day in the product for the last 20 days. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary. They know as much about the product as I do, and they have as many good ideas about the product as I do. In fact, there's more good ideas for what we should do at Mahalo outside of our building in Santa Monica than inside of our building, because there's only 30 people here, and there's, you know, 3 billion people out there. So, you know, the 5 million people who come to Mahalo every month have in aggregate, much better ideas than we do about how to use this product. We just have to figure out ways to get that information out of them and into our product.
How much of your time do you spend on social media? I do see you Twittering all the time. You've got Quick. Yeah. You're on Ustream for your video. All kinds of things.
Yep.
Does it take over your life? If somebody wants to match you, are they going to have to do this 3, 5, 8 hours a day?
Yeah, I don't really know how many hours I do it a day. I've looked at some of my those tweet statistics that show that I might do 10 a day or something. But, you know, for me, it's pretty straightforward. You know, the more I participate in those mediums, the more people get exposed to what we're doing. And I consider it an essential communication tool, because I'm not just communicating in those systems to our members and potential members. You got to remember, I'm also communicating to our team, our staff, our investors, potential partners, potential advertisers. You know, I go to business meetings with VCs or potential investors or the companies that have offered to acquire us, et cetera, and they ask about Taurus and Fondue, or they ask me how the Tesla's running. So I know they're watching the social media stream, and that asynchronous intimacy that's created benefits me tremendously. They are engaged in the storyline of my life, and by extension, the company and the product's life. So it's pretty essential for me, and it's very efficient. You got to remember, if I Twitter something like, you know, today we're having a discussion, should we have PageRank, you know, passed, right now Mahalo Answers is all nofollow. So there's no PageRank pass through answering questions or asking questions on Mahalo. So if you go on there and you put up your domain names, you're not getting any of the, you know, PageRank 6 or 7 that Mahalo has passed onto your site. But we thought, well, gee, if you're a brown belt or a black belt in the system and you've built up a lot of credibility, maybe we should give you the ability to pass PageRank because your answers are actually valuable, and Google should know that when you point to Engadget as a source, or, you know, TechCrunch as a source, or VentureBeat or GigaOhm, that it is relevant. So we're thinking about turning off nofollow for the higher level people in the trust, in this trusted environment. You know, the top level curators, maybe that's a good idea. So I put that discussion out onto the onto Twitter and, you know, Facebook, whatever, and all of a sudden not only do I get feedback on the idea, I've sort of prepped the market for it. And when we launched Mahalo Answers, I kept talking about, you know, in my email newsletter and Twitter, I'm working on Project A. I can't make it to the web because of Project A. I kept mentioning Project A. It created a little momentum as to what's Project A. And then I said Project A launches on December 15th. And when we launched, there were a couple of hundred people who were live on the site waiting for it to launch. You know, you can't – that's – every entrepreneur dies for that. You know, people actually waking up to, you know, at midnight to see what it is. You know, there's only one – there's really, you know, one person who's really pioneered that. It's Steve Jobs. I mean – people are so disappointed that it didn't show up for Macworld. Everybody wants to know when the new products are coming. The fact that people, you know, get so enamored with him on stage launching a product is the ultimate testament to just what an amazing product development team he has created, machine, and what a good marketer he is. But it's not...
How does somebody start off? The reason that you have so many people who are coming into your website on day one of the launch is because you have a lot of followers on Twitter, on Facebook, right, on every network out there. If somebody were to start, where should they start to get to that level?
You're only going to get to that level after a decade in the business, creating brand value, you know, year after year. It doesn't happen overnight. There is no magic bullet. You know, my credibility went up as the number of interesting products I built went up. And, you know, even with a couple of duds in there, it's okay. You know, the fact is people go, hey, it's trying new stuff. I mean, listen, you know, Netscape, when I did the social, you know, news thing, didn't work out exactly as I wanted to. I only had 4 months to work on it. It's going in the right direction, certainly, but, you know, wouldn't put it down on my resume. I was like my biggest success. And Kevin Rose at Pounce and, you know, laid people off at Revision 3. I mean, but that's not what matters. What matters is that people actually will check out the latest show on Revision 3 if he asks them to, you know, and they'll check out Pounce or a new Pounce feature. But that's only after building up credibility. So I think people have an unrealistic expectation that they should have 10,000 people check something out. Start with 10. And 10, grows to 50, and then 50 grows to 500, then 5,000, then 50,000. And then when Steve Jobs does it, it's, 100 million people. I mean, the New York Times front page is Apple, is Steve Jobs anytime he wants it. And then at a certain point, it doesn't matter that you've, got that attention. What matters is what you produce. So, it's a function of time, I think.
Okay. So another thing that you brought up earlier is you talked about being internet famous. I feel like you're a celebrity online. Do you feel that? And are there any benefits to being internet famous?
I think internet famous is probably the lowest form of celebrity that's, on the totem pole, on the scale. The most famous internet people are less famous than, the least famous people on the least watched canceled reality television show on cable. The people on Celebrity are more famous than any internet celebrity. So, if you're not as famous as the person from The Biggest Loser or Rockstar in Excess who got canceled on week one, it's pretty sad.
But they're famous famous to people who don't matter. Let's be honest. The people who are watching the Celebrity Fit Club, most of them don't matter in any of our lives. Their fame is isolated. Your fame is within your industry, with investors who are much more likely to listen to your pitch, with business partners who are much more likely to work with you, and with potential acquirers who are then more likely to buy you out. Am I right, or am I missing something?
Yeah, you're missing something.
What am I missing?
cause and correlation.
What do you mean?
So, yes, there's a correlation with the fact that people will invest in a company I do, or buy a company perhaps, where I can get a meeting, but the correlation is not with my internet fame, if there is such a thing. It's with the fact that I have a track record, and that I've made money for investors before, and that I have ideas that people might think are credible. And so, the internet fame is not what's driving it. I think, honestly, the years of blogging and putting intelligent ideas out there, or trying to put intelligent ideas out there, or speaking at conferences and trying to have intelligent conversations, is what really did it.
What about being a brand? If internet famous then is the wrong way to look at it, what about becoming a brand online? You've talked about this in one of your newsletters.
Yeah, I think you're looking at the smoke, not the fire.
Tell me.
So, the smoke is, all the buzz and the, he's internet famous and the followers. But if you start getting down to what's down there, I started with some coals and a little bit of kindling. A little kindling that built into some coals that then built into the bonfire. Kevin Rose did the same thing, et cetera, et cetera, down the line. The core is I was a journalist who met a lot of people early on with Silicon Valley Reporter, and I wrote editorials, and people respected what I wrote. I built up some level of credibility. I built a second business, Weblogs Inc., that was sold and, had a pretty spectacular exit for 18 months. And built more credibility. Then I started blogging about topics, got more credibility. Then I did the TechCrunch event, which had a lot of people come to it, which again builds the credibility. So, you see this huge, smoke or, flames flying over the hill, but you don't see all the little wood that I set up and tried to light and really nurture in order to make that big raging fire. And what I think people do is they just take a couple of gallons of gasoline and dump it on some logs and think they're going to have a similar success. There has to be some there. There has to be some coals and something of substance at the base of it. And so, Kevin Rose, the other internet famous guy who gets put in the same sentence a lot, the core was he was a really intelligent guy on tech TV, and he made a really cool product and had a really good idea that the, delicious popular list was really like a voting mechanism. It was a very good observation. Josh Schechter had it first, but he didn't capitalize on it. Kevin Rose saw it, copied it, evolved it, and then made something even better. So people say, oh, Kevin Rose is internet famous, so now when he does something, it really is that he's done stuff that is really of substance. That's why he can walk into a VC and say, hey, fund Pounce or fund Revision 3. And they say, okay, there's a guy who created Dig. He's probably a smart guy. He probably has a couple of good ideas left in him. And so people get a little, they sort of get it backwards. They want to make all the smoke and the flames going everywhere, but they don't want to do the hard work of building the kindling of a reputation. And so I've been going to internet conferences and writing about the internet since 1994, 14 years. And so there are people who've been reading what I write for 14 years. And that's the difference. You know, and people, I think, expect, oh, well, I'm going to write my blog for a year or two and I'm going to be internet famous. Yeah, maybe you get your stuff on TechMeme once in a while, but, you know, come back when you've done five. You know, I think if you want to have some level of success and expertise, put 5-7 years into something and then try to see the result. People have a very short time horizon. They think they're going to build a brand in a year or two or three. It really is 5 to 7. And if you're talking about your personal brand, it might be, you know, 7 to 15 before you actually start seeing those benefits. So, you know, yeah, good for me. I can walk in, I can get investment for, you know, if I have a decent idea, I can probably get investment for it. That's fabulous. But the truth is, I only have so many things I can do anyway. So, you know, it's not like I can do 5 startups at once. I'm going to do one. So, you know, it's great, but it's not as good as maybe people make it out to be. And it's not that I can just walk in and tell a VC, like, hey, give me money. I have to work hard just like everybody else. I got to convince them. I got to sell them. Maybe I'm better at it than some people have more experience at it, or maybe I have a better idea, or maybe I can get the meeting easier. But I got to get in there and sell. I got to answer the same questions. It's not people don't just write me a blank check. I mean, there are some who would give me a blank check, I guess, but, you know, typically that's not how it goes. It's hard work, and it comes after a lifetime of, you know, being in one industry and being everywhere. Go to every event, you know, go to 5 or 10 events per month for 5 years, blog every day for 5 years, be intelligent, have some empathy, and then you'll have a brand. It's really that simple. But people don't want to put hard work in, I think. I think everybody wants this, like, instant, like, get to 10,000 Twitter users as quick as possible. Who cares how quick you get there? Just do it credibly.
So you've stopped blogging, but you're still an advocate of blogging as a way of building reputation and building contacts?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think blogging has fundamental problems. And it's not very appealing to a guy like me, because once you get to the supposed A-list, you're basically a target for anybody who wants to link bait you, or, you know, the quickest way, and this is the problem I was talking about before of how people want to get famous quickly. The quickest way to become famous is to just attack somebody who already is. So just take, you know, Mike Arrington or Kevin Rose or Robert Scoble and just attack them brutally. Right or wrong, you're going to get some traffic. And that link baiting, which some people credit me with creating, I never, you know, heard of the term until people attributed it to me as being the master link baiter. I always just did spoke from the heart and just said passionately what I believe. You know, I think pay per post is a scam. You know, all the different battles I fought over the years for things I thought were right or wrong, were just, I didn't do it because I was link baiting. I just did it because that was my opinion. And now it's gotten to the point where people aren't saying how they actually feel. They're actually strategically trying to build links. They're strategically trying to get to the top of TechMeme. And that's why I think blogging is broken.
You didn't do that when you started Mahalo. You soon afterwards started talking about Squidoo. You didn't do that because you knew Squidoo was a big target, because Squidoo was potentially competitive, at least in people's minds, with Mahalo?
In another situation? I actually wrote about Squidoo before I even had the idea for Mahalo, and I thought it was part of the problem that got me focused on coming up with the idea for Mahalo. Because I looked at it and I said, wow, that's great. Users can build pages. But there's 150 pages on Paris, and the top 20 I looked at are all affiliate spam with stolen content.
So why not send the founder, Seth Godin, an email and say, hey, I saw some problems. I'm obviously somebody in this industry you can help. Let me help you out. You intentionally, though, blogged about it because he was a well-known target. His site was big enough for you to take aim at. I'm not putting you down for it. I want to learn from the way you've done things.
Yeah, it wasn't like I started that fight with some agenda. I would blog about trends I see. You know, I said I thought YouTube wasn't a real business. And I'm probably, at best, 30% correct in that assumption. I mean, YouTube's had a real problem becoming a business, obviously, everybody knows, but it also got sold for $1.6 billion and is 25% of all searches. So there's a real business there, but it also has real business problems and fundamentals. So I was sort of a third right, maybe, but I didn't write it because I wanted to give Chad Hurley a hard time. I've actually become friendly with the guy. He's a really nice guy. I wrote it because I thought it was the truth.
And I all said, right, but is the truth that it probably doesn't have a business, but it might also have a business, and the truth isn't as clear-cut as YouTube isn't a real business. It's a lot. It's a lot more nuanced than that, and you could have explained all of that, but you intentionally went for a stronger message, right?
I used the headline, "I don't believe YouTube's a real business," and that was my belief. I didn't think it was a real business. When I looked at it, I said, this business is based on people stealing content and putting it up there and then getting the number one result for Lazy Sunday because, you know, Saturday Night Live and NBC are too stupid to realize the value of their content and put it up. So now somebody's created a piracy service that allows you to do that and unleash that pent-up demand. That's why I wrote the article. That's why I titled it. If I said Squidoo is, you know, filled with spam in a back alley, that's because that's how I felt about it, and I felt it's a problem in the industry. And that's, I think, part of the wonderful thing about blogging is that, you know, it's not some backroom discussion. It's something that occurs in public so everybody can talk about it. But I didn't attack, you know, Seth Godin and say, Seth is a bad guy. I said, the service is bad. The service is being used for nefarious reasons. Look at these 20 pages. This is a disaster. This has turned into an affiliate spam, you know, AdSense trap. And so, you know, I think maybe some people perceive it as, you know, I'm attacking somebody or, you know, I have some agenda when I do it. Just writing how I feel. But I've actually moved away from those posts, actually, because they, I think, cause too much trouble for me just in terms of my day-to-day life. Like, the person who was on my board from Sequoia, Roloff Botha, was on the board of YouTube. He brought that in, you know, it's like, it just creates too much drama in my life. So now I've actually changed my writing style, stopped doing the blogging, talking about current news, and just try to constrain myself to the topic of entrepreneurship and where I see the market going and sort of a bigger picture. And since I started doing that, I think 13 or 14,000 people signed up for the email newsletter in 4 months.
What's the benefit to you of doing that, of helping startups build their companies? They're not necessarily going to work with Mahalo. Why?
No, it's personally rewarding. I find for every piece of information I put out there, I get 3 or 4 good ones in return. So when I send those newsletters out, one, I do it because I like to give back and help other entrepreneurs because I love entrepreneurship, which is the same reason why I, you know, brought the idea for TechCrunch 50 to Mike Arrington and said, hey, let's do this conference. And the same reason he did it, which was not to make money, it makes money, but to help those 50 companies launch. Because I thought there should be a place for them to launch where they didn't have to get, you know, reamed for $20,000 for 6 minutes on stage. So I like to help. I like to share what I've learned because the more I share, the more I get back. And every
time, what do you get back? For example,
400 or 500 emails every time I send one. So I send one email, I get 400 or 500 responses directly back to me. And, you know, some of these are from famous, you know, billionaire major names in the industry that just say, great email, your best email yet, which is, you know, feels nice to have somebody smart confirm what you're thinking. And then other ones say, you know, you're absolutely right about these four things, but you totally missed it on these two. Nice. You know, you left out this part and you left out that part. And so it gets me thinking, and I like to think about things. I'm a thinker, and I like to debate stuff. And so, you know, I travel the world, you know, doing these speaking gigs. Every time I go somewhere, you know, I probably have 300 or 400 people from Japan, 300 or 400 people from Korea, 300 or 400 people from Greece, you know, 1,000 people from London on the list. So I get to really get an international perspective. And then when I go to do my next thing, I put it out there. So I was looking for a conference producer. I sent it to the list. I got a couple hundred people back. So the list allows me some modest amount of promotion and or service back in order for what I give. And I really like this idea of email because email inboxes are so intimate that people don't sign up for email newsletters anymore. So I basically challenge people to say, you know, and challenge myself, I want to create an email relationship with you. I'm going to email you once every 2 or 3 weeks, and you're going to at least know that I put a couple hours of work into it, and I really thought about it. If it sucks, I'm really sorry, but at least you know I tried. And the feedback I've gotten back from doing probably 30 emails to 13,000 people is pretty fantastic.
All right. I've sent you emails in the past. You respond. You respond to emails. I send you respond to emails other people send. And if you don't respond, it's intentional, but you're getting through your inbox. How do you get through so much email? BlackBerry and iPhone, and you're constantly responding to emails?
I probably get back to, I get about 400 a day, and I try to respond to, you know, of those, let's say 200 or 300 are cold calls. I try to get back to half of them, a third of them. It really depends. You know, a lot of times I'll be sitting there playing poker. I'm not in the hand. Somebody sends me an email. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, and I just write back, thanks, you know, or not interested, or, you know, here are some thoughts. And sometimes sometimes I'll write something really long and considered back to somebody. It really depends on the type of email. If somebody writes me like an 8-page email that's like their life story, it's very hard for me to respond to it. But if somebody writes me like, hey, you know, this is my website, what do you think? Or do you think people want to use, you know, Teslas, or do you think they want to use Better Place and swap out their batteries? Yeah, sure, I'll respond. You know, what was it? It doesn't cost me that much.
Do you have any tips for people who are trying to get through their email?
Getting through their email box. We live on email here, and we have Yammer and IRC, so we sort of over-communicate, and we're in a big open office. So right now I'm in Tyler's sort of cube. He's got three walls, but I sit out now with everybody else at a desk, so there's no walls around me, and I sit, you know, amongst 25 people or so. So if there's any conversations that need to occur, they can typically occur, you know, leaning over desks or at lunch. We have staff lunch every day, 4 days a week, and most people come to it, so... that works really well too, you know, just sitting and breaking bread and having lunch with people, taking them to Disneyland, as you know.
I've heard.
During a recession, I should be shot for trying to have fun and motivate people, I know.
All right, PR. Eric Stevens says that one of the reasons that he works for you is because he just learns a lot, and from hearing him talk, learning from you on the job is probably more valuable to him than the salary you give him. And one of the areas...
Sorry. I'm thinking of cutting his salary.
yeah, blame me. So he says that he's learned a lot from watching you promote through public relations to get new features out in the media. Do you have tips to teach the rest of us?
Yeah, sure. I believe in doing a media tour when you have a new product. I was a journalist, and I always appreciated when somebody would show me a new product ahead of time. I always like to be, you know, a couple of weeks ahead of the public. That's your job as a journalist. So when Mahalo Answers came out 10 days before launch, we made a list. We have a big list of all the, you know, people who essentially we're friendly with, you know. Then we think about the product and which, you know, how it relates to the different people, and we just email them and say, we've got a new product. If you'd like to see it. It'll take about 20 minutes, and we'll set up an Adobe Connect, WebEx, whatever, or come by the office, or we'll come to your office. And I do it myself personally. I think it's important the CEO do it. If it's important enough for a journalist to take 20 minutes out of their time, it's important enough for the journalist to talk directly to the CEO. I open up the laptop, and I show it to them. And it's no press release, no pretense, just here's the product. Any questions? And I think that where people get wrong is they do a PowerPoint slide. They try to. I wrote an article about how to demo your product recently, and you know it's very nuanced things. Like, you know, you can email a journalist twice, you know, to set up a meeting, but after that, just give up and don't call them because they don't want to be called, and don't call them and ask them if they got your email. They got it. They're ignoring you, and if you can't get the Walt Mossberg or the Mike Arrington, then get, you know, the next tier down, you know, the Gear Live or the whatever it is, Engadget or whatever. You know, although people would argue Engadget is on par with Walt Mossberg probably today in terms of influence. But you get the idea. Yeah. You can't expect every journalist to take – I don't even expect it, to be honest. And even when I ask, I get passes. You know, I'll get a pass from the New York Times. I'll get a pass from the Wall Street Journal. When we're launching a new product, sometimes I get people who just demand to just get a login and not have me show it to them, and I say no thanks, that's not really, I like to show it to people and explain the thinking. I don't like to just send an email and a password. So I think the press tour is very good. Give everybody the same embargo date. Don't give somebody an exclusive. Tell everybody, you know, Monday 12 o'clock as the embargo lifts. You can do your story 12:01. And, you know, if you made a good product, you're not a BS artist, it'll probably work out okay.
And when Eric talked to us about how good you are at getting media for new features, Otis Chandler, who's the founder of Goodreads, said, you know, I never would have thought to promote a new feature or a new aspect of the company to the media. Should you, when you have a new feature, take it out to the media and suggest that they write something about it? Or when do you know what to take out?
Yeah, you don't want to waste our time with something that's not... I mean, there's features and there's products, so typically, if it's a feature, you know, we don't bring it up. If it's a product, we do a press tour. So when Mahalo came out, we did a press tour. When the toolbar came out, it had some special features, Mahalo Share, we did a tour. When Mahalo Answers came out, we did the new homepage. And, you know, I find that people, the journalists, if it's a company of note, they just want to check in with you twice a year anyway. So this is just their excuse to check in with you generally. I have the edit advantage that they may want to talk to me about something else. They may want to talk to me about what I think of YouTube or Facebook or TechCrunch 50 or the Tesla. So I have a lot of times they'll ask me a couple of questions that aren't about Mahalo, which is fine. I'm willing to do that, obviously. You know, if you do something that's meaningless or, you know, so insignificant that you wasted their time, you're going to lose credibility. So I would do something that's kick-ass, and I would have it working, and I would show them something that, you know, if you show them something and you deny the sort of market, you are going to get caught. Journalists are smart. So when we did Mahalo Answers, the first thing I did was say, you know, here are the top five answer sites out there. Here's Yahoo Answers, here's Wiki.Answers, and here's Naver and Down that you might not know about and what they're doing in Korea. I just got back from Korea. Here's the competitive landscape. Here's what, you know, everything I've learned about knowledge exchanges. Here's what we're doing that's different. We realize that knowledge exchanges exist. We realize they've been a tremendous success in terms of traffic. We realize that they haven't been a tremendous success in terms of quality. So we want to make something that's a lot higher quality. Here's how we plan on doing that. We have a virtual currency. Nobody's ever done that. We have multimedia style answers where you can put images and videos and audio files in it. And we have a curation team that deletes bad answers or obnoxious answers 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We pay them $10 an hour. They work from home. And so the best way to make the quality of a site go up is to get rid of the misspellings and the bad stuff. And what I just told you in probably 30 seconds is exactly what I told people over a 20-minute session with examples, showing, not telling. I don't have the ability to show you right now. I would if we were sitting in front of a computer. But anyway, that same process holds true with the journalists. And so have something of significance. If it's not significant, you probably don't want to waste their time.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about failures. Have you had any big failures that you think the rest of us can learn from?
Yeah, I mean, my first company, Silicon Valley Reporter, you know, was really on top of the world, 70 employees, $12 million a year in revenue, and then got crushed in 1 year down to $600,000 in revenue and a dozen employees or so. And that was pretty brutal for me. I had to lay off a lot of people. Obviously went from, you know, being on top of the world to, you know, having to renegotiate every contract and people calling to get their bills paid and fighting with people to get my bills paid that they owed me money. It was brutal, and I'm actually writing a big email newsletter about this one. You know, what to do if your company's going to go under. And I wound up selling that. I wound up at Dow Jones, and it was, I would say, barely a single. It was sort of like getting on base by getting hit with the ball in the head. So, you know, I got whacked so hard with the ball, somebody else had to go take my base for me. it was a pretty bad situation. And I had been offered $20 million for that company. I didn't take it because I thought it was too low. So I learned a lot, which is why I sold Weblogs Inc. after only 18 months. Because I was like, this is a good deal. 18 months, you know, this amount of money. We're taking it. We're done. it's a failure in some ways. The first company, I would never describe it as such, but it was painful to shift gears and have to lay people off. I should have sold it, sure. I don't know how much that stock would have been worth because it was stock in a public company that became worth much less. Internet.com, Alan Meckler's company. So I probably would have walked away with $1 million or $2 million of the 20 because his stock got crushed, and I would have been locked up. But anyway, you know, money is not really the driving force, so I don't really look at it as a failure. It was a success because I learned so much, and it made me the entrepreneur I am doing that job for 7 years. I learned a lot on the job being a journalist.
So somebody who's watching this either now or in a year is going to go through the same thing. They're going to have a company that they love get crushed. What advice do you give them? What do you tell them?
I think it's very important to show honor in the face of failure. So I think sticking it out and cleaning up the mess is very important. I did that. Taking responsibility for the mess is important. If you have to lay people off, you should do it yourself. You know, take them in a room and just tell them, like, hey, I suck. You know, it didn't work out. Here's why. You know, if there's anybody to blame, it's me. I'm the boss. And I'm sorry. And I'll be a great reference for you. And you got to be able to look your landlord in the eye and say, by the way, company's going to go out of business. And I'm sorry that you're not going to have this lease done. I did my best. You understand? You know, I mean, I think you have to be a class act as you're unwinding these things, because people remember. I remember the people who were my lieutenants and which ones left me when things got bad and which ones stood by me. I've since had some of those lieutenants from Silicon Valley Reporter and stuff like that come back to me and say, I'm sorry, I left when things got hard. I know you needed me and I feel bad about it. And I said to them, don't worry about it. You know, everybody reacts to stress differently. So if you're up against it and your company's going to collapse, some people will walk away. They can't handle the stress. But it's important for you as a leader to, you know, it's sort of like the Titanic, you know, like the last guy in the lifeboat should be the captain. His responsibility is to get as many people into the lifeboat as possible other than themselves. And it's honorable to die with the ship, I think. You know, as a captain, I would rather go down with the ship than, you know, get taken off first while other people drown, you know. I don't know, it's a matter of honor, you know. I think you should close up gracefully as much as you can. That being said, if the people around you are not acting honorably, you know, if you're, you know, facing being ousted by your VCs or board and they don't want you there, then you should just have a very frank conversation with them and say, if you want me here, here's what we're going to do. And if you don't, and you disagree and you think somebody else would be better at this, I'm more than willing to step aside. I think that is also an honorable thing to do, is just, you know, if the people who have invested in you are no longer confident, I don't see the point in fighting them. There's a bunch of opportunity out there. Go do something else.
All right. Finally, Jason, I've got you on the phone. I've got to learn as much as I can from you, for myself. What I'm doing here is at Mixergy trying to bring a mixture of different ideas to entrepreneurs like you from other entrepreneurs, other successful people who can teach. What can I do differently? What can I do to be more useful?
Certainly people want to hear, you know, discussions from entrepreneurs about the good and the bad. So I think you're doing a good job by answering the bad, asking about the bad as well. I think people would probably like to hear the same questions posed to a series of people, and I would edit those answers together. So if you asked everybody in your interviews, you know, what's the worst experience you've had as an entrepreneur and how did you get through it? If you could do some, it's one thing to do the interview, right? I do a lot of podcast interview, but adding a layer of analysis and value over that is critical to differentiate yourself from the other 100 podcasts out there with Mark Andreessen or me or whoever. So if you could say, I talked to 10 different entrepreneurs about failure. Here's what they said. Here are the themes. Five of them said, they learned more from failure than they did from success. Seven of them said, they should have shut down businesses earlier than they did. 10 out of 10 said they don't regret their failures, they learned from them. You know, now you've done some layer of analysis and value on top of the raw data, a level of curation. And that's what I'm doing with Mahalo to a certain extent. That's what I believe the future of media is. That's where I think the value is in the value chain. If all knowledge has become commoditized, what has value after knowledge commodification? Analysis, critical thinking, packaging, those kind of things. So it sounds corny, but if you did five graphs based upon, you know, your collection of interviews with yes, no's and pie charts, people like pie charts. You could get more out of those five pie charts and more play than you would out of, 20 hours of video. I mean, that's the Robert Scoble you know, what Robert Scoble's not good at is editing. You know, he's great at asking questions. He's great at, you know, being, he's a great product person, actually. He really shouldn't be doing interviews with people. He should just be doing a, he should be a, like a product manager and a budsman. I tried to hire him as Mahalo's budsman. I hired him to be like a third party, you know, tell us how to make the product better, talk to the users kind of person. He didn't take it. He went to Podtech or something insane, or Fast Company. Would have been a good job. Anyway, I think you have to provide a layer of deeper analysis and challenge yourself to do something more than, I mean, this entrepreneur discussion goes on all the time. Entrepreneur Magazine, you know, my email newsletter. Why do I have 13,000 people in the email newsletter? Because I go deep. And so this interview is now at 1 hour and 8 minutes. I don't know if you put it out in whole or if you edit it or whatever, but go deep is my advice and do something of significance.
I see. And that goes for everyone who's creating content now on the internet. Go deep, add more analysis, add more curation.
I think they have to, you, I mean, the reblogging phenomenon and just opinion, for, you know, for opinion's sake is not going to get people very far at this point. There's too much opinion out there. Frankly, not enough original reporting, too much opinion. You know, everybody's got an opinion on, you know, what's the right solution for energy. But it's not a lot of action about it, you know, or people saying, you know, like, I installed, you know, these two windmills at my house and I installed this, you know, solar panels. Here's what I got. I talked to my friend. Here's what he got. And that's where Engadget actually and Autoblog started to do really well and get five times as much traffic as their competitors at Gawker Media was because we actually test drove cars at Autoblog. We did Inside the Autoblog Garage. And we were the first blog to actually get cars from the manufacturers. They wound up getting a Ferrari and a Bentley and other, you know, exotic cars eventually because we'd done such a good job with the regular cars. But those were real car reviews for, that we did over 3 days, taking a ton of pictures, taking a ton of video. We went deeper when everybody else was going lighter and fast.
How you also went, you got access to cars when most bloggers were being ignored, and you got access to top cars, as you say. Why do they pay attention to Autoblog when they ignored everyone else?
Well, we had some traffic, and we called them constantly, and we kept banging. You know, probably the first 10, 20 times we called, they didn't return our calls. But, you know, then, you know, the 21st time, and we send them three links that show the cars that we've already looked at, and, you know, we go find some dealership that lets us review the car, and we show them the, you know, the thoroughness of it. Yeah, okay, I've seen you've done three real good ones. I'll give you a Mercedes. You know, then you show them the Mercedes and the BMW, and then all of a sudden Tesla says, yeah, we'll do it. And then Tesla does it, then Ferrari does it. Ferrari does it, you send the Ferrari one to Bentley. So you just, you sort of build off your previous hits. You know, it's just like an independent filmmaker. Darren Aronofsky made Pi, his first film, for $60,000. He just made The Wrestler for $5,000. Between that, he made, you know, The Fountain for $50,000 or something. I mean, you know, filmmakers go through this all the time. They're constantly having to prove themselves and hustle to get stuff. You know, if you're in the media business, it's a nonstop hustle. It never ends. Nor should it. No. It's competitive.
Well, thank you. Is there anything that I missed? Anything that people need to know?
They need to know that they should check out Mahalo Answers. If they have a startup company they want to launch, TechCrunch 50 will be opening up application process soon. It'll be in September again, of course. And we make the decisions by May or June. So you're going to want to have your product done by June, July, you know, have something to show in May, June. We'll probably make the final decisions in July, August for September. So if you have a startup company, get it ready for TechCrunch 50. Look at the people who presented on stage. We like a mix of innovation and actual built products. So we like the product to launch on stage. So it's not a business plan competition or who can make the best mock-ups. It's who can make the best product. So if you have a product idea and you want to start your company in year two or three in terms of promotion, TechCrunch 50 is the best way to do it. You're going to get out to probably 50 or 100,000 people the day you launch at the event, and you'll probably get out to a 1/4 million people in the weeks after that.
And if they, just from the statistics, if they show it to you, not tell you, show you the product, show let you
tell.
See it.
Right. Show yeah, anybody tell. Can tell me they're going to make a better dig. If you show me the better dig and why it's better in a coherent fashion, good. You know, everybody wants to make better search results than Google. Show me the result. Put your result next to Google's. And tell me why it's qualitatively better. Show me which exact link is better and which one is worse. And rate the links. You know, that's what I do. That's how I got Walt Mossberg to allow me to demo Mahalo at the D conference 2 years ago. I showed him my result for Paris Hotels and for Paris and for Apple Pie, and I showed Google's. And I said, see the spam? There's 4 spam out of the top 10 in Google results. And there's, you know, 3 in these Yahoo results. And in mine, there's none. So the question is, can I make this scale? And I think I can, because I got a lot of money in the bank, and I got a lot of time to figure it out. And he was like, okay. But I showed him. And that guy's used to getting BS'd all the time by people who tell him they're going to create something that's going to change the world, but they don't show it. The product speaks.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for doing this interview, Jason.
Peace.
Bye.
Good time. Right. Thanks.
Awesome.
All right, and there's the end of the interview. You are the person that I do these interviews for, the person who listens all the way to the end, the person who my guess is, and you tell me, you send me an email, let me know if my hunch is right. I am guessing that you're the kind of person who does not listen to music on an iPhone, but instead listens to programs like this, who downloads stuff from audible.com or from other podcasts or from other programs. And for years you've been doing this because you want the edge. You want to find out what it's going to take to build your company, what it's going to take to build your baby into something that, as I said in the beginning of this program, will outlive you, will leave that legacy and help you change the world. You're the person I want to meet. Come back to Mixergy.com and find one of the millions of ways, it seems, that you can connect with me, including just plain old email. I'd love to meet you. I also would love for you to go back to Mixergy.com, M-I-X-E-R-G-Y, and find other programs like this one that you can use to feed your mind and feed your ambition, because, baby, that ambition is what's going to get you to keep on going, and that ambition is going to get you to come up with the new ideas that will create the products that will get you to the cover of Forbes magazine or Fortune magazine. And you remember what happens when you get there, right? Give a little mention over to Andrew Warner and say that interviews like this are what got you there. See you on Mixergy.com.